Thank you, Ken. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I want to send a special greeting out to those who may be with us by phone. Charles Hunting, if you're out there, and anyone that is going to be listening by tape. When I first saw this lectern, I looked at it and said, is that a lectern or a cockpit? It's got a control panel that spans the whole width of it with knobs and dials and switches and lights and stuff. And it reminded me of Romans, is it Romans 10:14? How can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without high tech? Especially in the back where I've been sitting. For most Christians, an understanding of God, Jesus, and their relationship to each other should be based on a scriptural foundation. And for many, John 1:1 is the cornerstone of that foundation, summing it up in a few short words. Its simplicity, rhythm, and cadence are eloquent in the Greek. Okay, this can't all be in English, okay? En arche en hologos, kai hologos en proston teon. Kateos in Pologos. There's an eloquence to that. And that simple eloquence is preserved in the English. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The traditional view of this verse is familiar. It identifies the Word as the one later known as Jesus. So in this view, in the beginning of the Word it was the Word means Jesus existed before creation. And the Word was with God means Jesus was with the Father, but was different or distinct from the Father. And the Word was God means Jesus was God. This mainstream or traditional teaching is viewed by most professing Christians as of utmost importance, a doctrine so basic that it must be essential, a definitive Christian belief. Yet, because it asserts that two or three distinct persons comprise one God, that teaching is also acknowledged to be extremely difficult, an unfathomable mystery, as they say. It's a doctrine so daunting that no human being can hope to understand it in a meaningful way, at least in this life. But if this concept were so essential, why would God have made it so difficult or even impossible to comprehend? Does that make any sense? What if, instead, John's message were simple, its meaning straightforward? What if his original audience actually could understand it in ways that later generations, for whatever reasons, could not? What did these words mean to their author, John? And I accept the authorship of John, even though some scholars dispute it. And for those for whom he wrote, have any clues to their meaning been overlooked? This study will look at three things. The first verse of John's Gospel, and two words in that verse, words that may have been misunderstood. Each of these will be viewed from a different perspective. First, one of those two words will be viewed from the perspective of Greek cosmology. It's the Greek understanding of the nature and the origin of the universe, the cosmos. Second, the other word will be examined from the standpoint of Greek diction, or the appropriate usage of words. We will ask, what did these true crucial words really mean to the author and to his original audience? Thirdly, we'll look at the verse as a whole from the perspective of John's own evangelical purpose, his reason for writing the gospel, as he himself expressly declared it. The two words in question are logos and pros. These two key words each have an abundance of meanings. Now, authors sometimes use words with an abundance of meanings with the very intent that they be taken in more than one way to enrich their significance. And John may have done just that. He may have intended this sentence to be understood in more than one sense. He may have even expected that his Jewish and his Greek readers and hearers would have understood it in two different but compatible ways, both true. but a full examination of that is beyond the scope of this study. What this study does do is suggest some unusual views. However, these views are not to be set forth dogmatically as the only true views, excluding all others. Even if true, they would not necessarily exclude other biblically valid interpretations, since John could indeed have had more than one meaning in mind. These are offered instead as additional possible ways of understanding this verse and the two Greek words, upon which hinges its meaning. The study grows out of an attempt to understand John 1:1, particularly to understand what the Logos meant in its original context. It stems from a search for a simpler, clearer understanding, a simple, straightforward, down-to-earth understanding. It looks for meaning that makes sense, one that really makes sense to ordinary people. It seeks a sense of these words that even a fisherman's son might use, and that even the weak of the world could understand. In other words, something that is anything but an unfathomable mystery. John 1:1 says the Word was in the beginning, evidently the same beginning as the one in Genesis 1:1. Word, of course, is the Greek word logos. And the Word, or logos, is said to have been with God. With is translated from the Greek word pros, P-R-O-S, transliterated into English. To understand this verse correctly, we must first understand the meaning of these two Greek words, logos and pros. Logos, like word in English, has a broad range of meanings. Logos is used in the Septuagint to translate devar, or word in Hebrew. Devar is the word of the Lord that came to the prophets, God communicating his message or manifesting himself to them in some way. Word is also understood to be by many to be the self-expression of God. In the New Testament, the Word of God is usually understood as either the written Word, the Holy Scriptures, or the personal Word, Jesus Christ. The Logos appears as Word dozens of times in the New Testament. There are only six places where Logos, though still translated Word, is understood to refer to God or Jesus Christ. All six occur in writings attributed to John. Only John, of all the New Testament writers, uses logos in this way. In these quotations, since the meaning of logos in Greek may be distorted by our familiar connotations that we give it in English, I'm going to usually use logos instead of word. Of these six special uses of logos, three of them are found in this very verse, John 1:1. Logos appears again in verse 14, and the logos was made flesh and dwelt among us. And it reappears in this sense only two other times, as the logos of life in 1 John 1:1 and as the logos of God in Revelation 19:13. Though logos is the Greek word for word, that, of course, is only its most basic meaning. It is really much richer, with a broad, much broader range of meanings than the English word. Depending on the context, logos can mean a thought, concept, idea, discourse, reason, or an explanation. It can mean an entire rationale for something. And as Enos just pointed out, logos can also be put on shirts. Now, here may be the first clue. Although it is not well known except to scholars who interest themselves in such things, several centuries before Jesus' birth, logos took on a new and specialized meaning, one unrelated, of course, to Jesus Christ. By the first century, logos had become a well-known technical term in Greek philosophy, especially in the field of cosmology, the study of the nature and the origin of the cosmos or universe. Yet to most Christians today, that meaning is still virtually unknown. This unique sense of logos may well be a clue to the meaning of John 1:1. Why has this sense remained so obscure to most people? Was it suppressed by scholars who knew about it? Was it just ignored? These questions, too, are beyond the scope of the study, but they deserve answers. This specialized use of logos is attributed to Heraclitus, a Greek philosopher who lived in Ephesus about a century or so before Socrates. As mentioned before, one of logos' meanings is a rationale for something. Heraclitus expanded on that, giving logos a significant new cosmological sense. What was that sense? As Raymond E. Brown put it in his Anchor Bible appendix on the logos, it was the rational principle in the universe that makes it an organized cosmos, the transcendent, ultimate source of the natural order of things. Logos, used in this way, is the one Greek concept closest to the biblical God. Now, this logos at first was not considered a person, as the gods of mythology were. It was instead seen as an abstract or impersonal force, an ideal. And as an ideal or a concept, the Greeks would have thought of the logos as perfect, utterly unlike the mythological gods with their glaring character flaws. By the first century, this meaning of the logos had spread throughout the ancient world, and it spread to non-Greeks as well. One prominent Jew who used logos profusely in this special sense was Philo, a Jewish philosopher and a contemporary of Jesus and John, who used logos in this way over 1,200 times. His writings reflect his attempts to find common ground between Greek thought and Hebrew scripture. Philo identified the logos as God's intermediary or his mediator in creation. Now, since Philo was a monotheistic Jew, this logos to him was still not a person, but rather a personification like wisdom in Proverbs. Philo's concept of the logos as God's intermediary or mediator may have influenced the development of the second person of God concept in proto-Orthodox or Trinitarian theology, but that is also beyond the scope of this study. Pros, a Greek preposition, is the other key word. A correct understanding of John 1:1, of the nature of the Logos, and of the existence and nature of both Jesus and God, may all hinge on the meaning of this four-letter word. Though a very short word, its interpretation is not at all simple. And though its correct interpretation is utterly critical, it may well have been severely misunderstood. Like most Greek prepositions, pros is used with nouns in three grammatical cases. For each case, prepositions have a different range of meanings, and the sense is affected as well by the type of verb used. As one might expect, defining these is not simple. For this little word pros, Kittel's massive, unabridged theological dictionary of the New Testament has 5 pages of definitions and examples. Wayne, you see why I didn't put my definitions first? You will in a minute. On page 720 of volume 6, Kittel sums up these 5 pages on pros as follows. And I quote, "The general sense of pros is immediately before. With the genitive, however, it expresses a going out from. With the dative, being before or by something. With the accusative, movement to something." End quote. Since the accusative is used with pros in John 1:1, as it is in the New Testament virtually 99% of the time, we need not be concerned with the dative or the genitive. Though pros is translated here as with, that is not a common meaning of pros, especially with the accusative. But pros has many more meanings when used with the accusative case. Depending on the context, Kittle says that it could also mean any one of the following: at, among, towards, for, against, up to, so that, essential for, in agreement with, accord with, according to, pertain to, in relation to, belong to, and correspond to. What about with? Can prose ever mean with? Needless to say, Kittle addresses this question. He says, prose, when used with the accusative, as it is here, can only mean with in a limited sense under very special circumstances. Among uses with the accusative, in fact, Kittle cites John 1:1, this very verse, as an example. According to Kittle, prose can mean with in this verse under the following rather convoluted definition. As we will see, this definition involves a loose usage of an unusual instance of an exceptional case in an extremely narrow sense. Because of this, comments and emphasis will be added as I read the following quote. This is how Kittle says prose can mean with. Quote, in passive forms of verbs of motion, which have the sense of the perfect, and are which are to be construed intransitively, that's the extremely narrow sense, prose takes on the meaning of with, by, before someone or something, even though it is used with the accusative, that's the exceptional case. For the perfect expresses both the movement and the ensuing state, and in this case, the latter is the most important. That's the unusual instance. He goes on. This construction can be loosely used in cases where there is no relation to a verb of motion. That's the loose usage. In other words, translating prose here by with might appear to be a bit of a stretch, to say the least. Now, did John understand all of that? For that matter, did any of you understand that? Clearly, some kind of a relationship is meant by prose, but translating it with also poses a serious problem in logic. The Logos is with God. The Logos is God. It's the logical contradiction of simultaneous identity and distinctness. Though prose has a broad range of meanings with the accusative, it typically expresses relationships that we would express with to or towards. You remember the long string of to definitions. As we have just seen, it is not a primary equivalent of with, and certainly not a straightforward one. However, there are other Greek prepositions that do mean with. Instead of prose, John often used meta or para to express the meaning of with. And he used them a lot. Sir Anthony cites a lot of these in one of his articles. Sun, or pronounced sin usually, S-Y-N, also means with. These other Greek words for with are familiar to us. They also appear as prefixes, not only in Greek, but in English. Syn, par, and meta, as in synergy, paralegal, and metaphysical. These, in contrast to prose, do really have a primary sense of with. Meta denotes accompaniment, amid, against, among, and with. Para denotes proximity, near, beside, in the vicinity of, nigh unto, and with. Soon or sin denotes union, with, or together. Sin also has to do with association, companionship, resemblance. Now, if John wanted to express such proximity, accompaniment, or even union, would not one of these be the word of choice instead of prose? but prose is used here instead. Why prose? What could the author have had in mind? Could it be that some other relationship is meant, that in this instance some other meaning of prose is more appropriate? Now, a clue to the proper meaning may lie, believe it or not, in John's evangelical purpose. John's purpose in writing this gospel is explicitly stated in John 20, verse 31. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. But his audience couldn't believe in this Son of God or even know who this Son of God was until John identified first the one he called God. So what was John trying to do here? In his latter years, John, the Apostle John, lived and worked in the city of Ephesus on the west coast of Asia Minor, where he oversaw the region's churches. John was a Jew, the son of a Galilean fisherman. He was not a Greek sophisticate steeped in the speculative thought of Greek philosophy, and his readers were not likely very sophisticated either. But could John have easily learned of this special sense of logos that gave shape and form to the cosmos that his audience already likely knew? Of course he could. So what was his purpose? Was John introducing the God of Israel to a largely Gentile audience, using the single concept that they knew that was closest to God? Or was John revealing a new, sophisticated, mysterious concept of God, one radically different from that of the Hebrew Scripture, the concept of a Godhead with two or three members? Could his audience figure that out? Or has anybody sense? What was his purpose here? Which makes more sense? Are there any more clues? Yes, perhaps there is one. Paul had faced a similar audience and a similar challenge in Athens. Acts 17 records the clever gambit that he used to introduce the one true God to the Athenians in a way that they could understand. Did that tactic of Paul inspire the first verse of John's gospel? Paul was, verse 16, greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Paul not only, verse 17, reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, he also spoke daily in the agora, the marketplace, which was a forum for commerce not only in goods, but in ideas. The philosophers hung out in the agora, and they took him on. I'm going to read Acts 17, verses 18 through 24. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. 19. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." Verse 21, all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. 22, Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth." And he went on, but I'm going to end the quote. Paul used an altar to the unknown God to explain the true God. For his hearers to understand, he had to use terms that they knew. And he even quotes their own poets. "As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." Verse 28. Now, the Areopagus met in the Agora, but under Roman rule, it governed only religion and morals, kind of like the Sanhedrin in Israel had been demoted. The NIV Study Bible says that they consider themselves the custodians of teachings that introduced new religions and foreign gods. Given Athens' love for the newest ideas, introducing a new religion was not illegal. But first, the Areopagus had to check it out. Well, as we know, the tactic worked. In verse 34, it says, certain men clave to him and believed, Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others. But would John have known of this story? Let's see if we can draw a connection. After Paul left Athens, he spent a year and a half in nearby Corinth, where he met and worked with Aquila and Priscilla. And then when Paul returned home, Aquila and Priscilla went with him as far as Ephesus, where Paul spoke to the church. And when Paul left Ephesus, they remained behind. So even if Paul himself didn't relate this story to the Ephesians, I think it's probably one of his favorites, Aquila and Priscilla could have done so. Paul's opening tactic in Athens could very well have been very well known to the Ephesian church. So even if John had not read about it in the book of Acts, he could well have heard it in Ephesus. Like Paul in Athens, John begins by explaining in verse 1:1, he begins by explaining who God is in a way that makes sense to his audience. He's using the familiar Greek cosmological concept of logos, and using that in this way would no doubt be especially effective with the Ephesians in Ephesus, since Ephesus was the hometown of Heraclitus, who first used logos centuries before to refer to the rational principle of the universe that makes it an organized cosmos. It's a hometown word, in effect. Since John uses the word logos and the words in the beginning, it would have been understood to his audience in its common cosmological sense. So like the men of Athens with their unknown god, they would see that he was pointing out the identity of their logos with the true God. Of all the meanings of the word pros we have seen, are there any that support this meaning? There may be at least one. As seen earlier, pros can convey the sense of correspond to. John is introducing the true God by identifying him with the logos, the single closest corresponding concept in Greek. The logos was utterly unlike the mythological gods with their manifold weaknesses and imperfections. The logos was unique and different, perfect, and the ultimate source of the natural order of things, the one that gave shape and form to the universe, that made it an organized cosmos. It was the one Greek concept closest to the supreme creator and lawgiver. While the Greek view couldn't encompass all that God is, of course, the logos, like Athens' unknown god, was at least a compatible concept. Now let's reread John 1:1, keeping in mind John's need to introduce the true God to a largely Gentile audience. He begins with the logos, the closest concept that they knew, and identifies that logos with God. Expanding the wording somewhat in the English for clarity, it might read something like this. In the beginning was the logos that gave shape and form to the universe, the cosmos. The logos that you know corresponded to God. In fact, that logos was God. But the Greeks already knew the logos well, just not the true God. So John actually just had to say this. In the beginning was the logos. And the logos corresponded to God, and the logos was God. If one understands what the logos meant to John's original Greek hearers, it's straightforward and simple. But Unlike Paul's hearers in the pagan Areopagus, John's audience consisted not only of Greeks, but of Jews and God-fearing Gentiles. Both of the latter groups knew the Hebrew Scriptures and would instantly recognize in his opening words the same beginning, in the beginning, as in Genesis. The Jews and the God-fearing Greeks may have seen in the Logos the word God breathed. Let there be light is echoed a few verses later. So John, it appears, is addressing both of these groups with a few simple words, words that each group would recognize as having a special and familiar meaning to them, each in their own different but compatible way. John addresses both groups with the same few words in the very same verse. Two birds with one stone. We have now examined from different perspectives two words and one verse. Logos from the viewpoint of Greek cosmology, pros from that of Greek diction, and John 1:1 from the perspective of John's evangelical purpose. First, Logos was the Greek concept closest to and most compatible with the God of the Scriptures. John exploited that similarity to explain who God was to the Greeks. Second, pros, while not a very good way to say with, is, however, a good way to say that two things correspond. Third, John's purpose here was not to introduce a revolutionary concept of a Godhead of two or three persons, a concept completely foreign to the Scriptures. Instead, John was simply introducing the biblical God to his Greek-speaking readers with a term they understood well. John's use of the Logos, in a similar way to Paul's use of the unknown God, was a perfect way to identify the God of the Hebrew Scriptures to a Greek-speaking audience in a way that both Greeks and Jews could embrace as their own. Before I take any questions, I need to say that I'm a cautious guy and I've developed the habit of reading the fine print on labels. So that warning label on the coffee caught my attention, and I have not been drinking a coffee since I've been here. So there may be some questions that I won't be able to answer. And I will have copies of this. Still need some proofing and editing, but I'll have updated copies available, maybe through ACD on the website or something later. I'm going to put these over near the saw right after this. Are there any questions? Wayne?
Yes, this is Wayne Anderson. That, Bob, that's great scholarship. Thank you very much. I very much like that. If the third part of the sentence is not that the word was God, but the word was divine, how would you change what you were just got through presenting to us? In other words, God is in the antharsis, so it's talking about deity or the qualities of God, not God himself. So
right.
The word logos was divine
instead. The question
is
concerning the third clause, the word theos is anarthis. It doesn't have the definite article. So it could or perhaps should be, in various opinions, taken as meaning divine instead of God. And I'm not sure that I have a concise or a good answer to that. That's really was beyond what I was looking into. I have a hunch that perhaps there is more ambiguity in that, but I'm not an expert in the Greek, so I can't address that.
I have a question.
Yes.
If the word is a one-to-one equivalent to God, that is corresponding to God, then God became human in verse 14. And that would be difficult, especially when we read later in 1 John, John's kind of against the idea of Jesus not being normally human. No, not have come in the flesh.
Let me repeat this and see if I see if I'm understanding you correctly.
I was just wondering how you, in your view, handle verse 14. How does that fit into the...
And the Word became flesh.
Right.
I think that also may be simpler than theologians have interpreted it. I think that God has planned this out in a way that is utterly simple, and then if we would look at it in a common sense way, it would become a lot clearer. That's why he uses a father-son relationship. That is pretty well known. And I believe that the Logos was what God was. It's everything he is. God doesn't have flesh, so he's spirit. But his power and his wisdom and his knowledge and his planning, all of that, I don't know how you can separate any of that. And I can't conceptualize it. God is a mystery. But of himself, of his very being, somehow he conceived, or he begot, pardon me, he begot in Mary a son. Now, because Jesus was human, he inherited that humanity from his mother. There had to be, and I don't think God would have done anything more extraordinary than was necessary. So there was probably an ovum from which Jesus inherited all of his fleshly characteristics, his human nature and so forth. And I think that probably the easiest, and this is speculation on my part, obviously, I don't know how it happened, but the easiest thing in my mind for God to have done was to, of his own spirit, produce a sperm in Mary's body that then united with that ovum. The sperm would have been totally compatible with human flesh, but it would not be human in origin. It would have been converted from spirit to flesh. Does that make any sense?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm just kidding with you.
Well, guess who? Okay. If God creates Adam out of dirt, he can create sperm.
But not a spirit sperm.
No, it's not a spirit sperm. It's a physical sperm with the chromosomes, the DNA, and everything. And so the physical, and if that, given that scenario, which is quite plausible and probability, and is a probable one, that God is the creator of Adam and the father of Jesus. He's also the father of Adam.
But when he created human.
I mean, sure.
Well, what he created was not what the in my belief, what he did was that the spirit became flesh. It was not human flesh at first. It was like humanity in all ways, but it didn't have a human origin, because it was made from scratch from God's spirit.
And Adam didn't have a human origin in that regard either. He came from dirt, but God formed it. Let's just say it was dirt. God formed it, breathed life into it. So the pneuma or the ruach, you know, was actually it wasn't even rat. Was Anthony would know the word, or you would know the word? No, when God breathed into Adam the breath of life, that's a different word.
Shama.
Okay.
Now once the spirit became flesh, and we'll say it's a sperm, it unites with the ovum, then those two become one human individual. And so in that sense, the spirit has become flesh, has become a human, has become Jesus. And that's the way, that's the closest thing that I can think of as analogy to how God, a spirit being, becomes a father of a human son.
You cannot have God impregnate an egg spirit with spirit. It has to be a physical conception, and therefore begotten.
I think he could have done that too. I mean,
well, he could have, but then you can have God as, but then you can have God as fully man or fully
DNA and or whatever. But it's just a lot more complicated.
Yeah, well, then
God's not going to do something more complicated, and he has to.
No, and we don't want to create the half man, half God business.
No,
unnecessarily. Okay. But and the other thing to address, I'm sorry.
Can we go on to another question? I didn't intend to talk about the incarnation.
This isn't a question as much as just an observance. Then, in a sense, that is what the Father does to us when we become a believer is that he imparts his spirit into our flesh that, you know, basically starts us on the road to immortality, correct?
Right. The observation is that this is a similar process to what happens to all of us when God imparts his spirit to us. It's not a part of his spirit. It's as if we were sharing his spirit an undivided interest in his spirit, to adopt a real estate term, because it's, I don't think the spirit can be divided, but we share the spirit in one way, and in the incarnation, I think God shared his spirit in a different way,
but are we making it too complicated in the fact that there's a miracle that takes place every time a baby is created, a baby is formed in a womb. So therefore, the only difference between us, Adam was formed out of the dust of the earth. All of us are formed from our father and our mother. The only difference between that was that Jesus was formed from without a man. Correct?
Well, you're saying that if there's a miracle that takes place every time a human being is conceived in the womb, it's astonishing, certainly, and something we can't really understand or comprehend or explain, but it is a natural process that was ordained by God in creation.
Right. So the miracle...
And so in that sense, it's not a miracle.
Yeah.
It's natural.
So the miracle of Jesus was there was no father.
I'm sorry?
I said the miracle of Jesus was that there was no earthly father.
Yes. As I understand it, and I could be wrong, the miraculous part of it is not... it's called the virgin birth. Well, the miraculous part was that God, of his own spirit, and without dividing his spirit, took, as it were, a portion of that, not a part, I don't know how to say it any better, and that became physical flesh. Not human in origin, but totally compatible with human flesh so that it could unite with an ovum. I don't know if it makes any more sense to you. But anyway, any more questions? I'm going to put these over there, probably under the saw if there's room. Okay? Thank you very much.
So wasn't that interesting? That was really interesting. Excellent, excellent job. And we'll post that on our website, so you can look it up anytime you want. And if there are more questions, probably, of course, Richard always has a bunch more. So we have some Q&A time coming up here a little later. I mentioned that Robert was very precise. He told me his presentation would be 32 minutes. I was watching my clock, and as on the recorder, as soon as it went from 31:59 to 32, he stopped. So I don't know if that was a miracle or what, but he's one of those kind of guys, you know. So. Did you? Well, that was quite good. And I'd read his paper before, not the one he's edited now the 15th time, but it was really fascinating, the whole concept of logos, why that would be chosen. You know, it's quite clever on John's part. And like you say, in just a few words, he brought together powerful concepts in a rhetorical way, to make his point, and it's quite good. And you laid some blame on Philo, right, for this personification idea. Was that was one of your suggestions, wasn't it? So that I found that kind of interesting as well.